From NPR and WBUR, I'm Mina Kim.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And what to make of four dozen or so questions leaked to the New York Times, purportedly the list of questions that FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller wants to ask President Trump as Mueller investigates Trump campaign contacts with Russians and possible obstruction of justice by the president. President Trump tweeted this morning, "So disgraceful that the questions concerning the Russian witch hunt were leaked to the media. No questions on collusion. Oh, I see. You have a made-up phony crime, collusion, that never existed, and an investigation begun with illegally leaked classified information. Nice." Among the most intriguing questions that Mueller reportedly wants to ask of the president, what knowledge did you have of any outreach by your campaign, including Chairman Paul Manafort, to Russia about potential assistance to the campaign? Let's bring in Phil Ewing, National Security Editor for NPR. And Phil, first to these questions. The Washington Post is saying it appears they did not come from the Mueller investigation. The Times says they came from outside the Trump legal team. But the implications seem to be that they came from the White House side of this equation. Do we know that they really are the full questions?
The White House has not addressed the veracity or completeness of the questions this morning. My colleague Aisha Roscoe was at the White House. She talked with someone there about it this morning, and they took a very similar line to the one that you just read from the president. They said, without confirming or denying that these are the real questions or the complete questions, we condemn and deplore the fact that they've appeared in the press. I think it's probably fair to say, based on the president's reactions, including the one you read, that this is very much like whatever his legal team probably has gotten or has generated itself out of their discussions with the special counsel's office. And the New York Times itself said that this was from a source outside Trump's legal team, which could mean anything. I mean, you and I and all of your listeners are outside of Trump's legal team, but clearly the indications are that that is probably what the origin of this was.
Okay, well, let's go through. A lot of focus on contacts with Russians, whether son-in-law Jared Kushner tried to set up a back-channel direct phone line to Russia during the transition, what President Trump knew about a real estate deal in Moscow, Trump's 2013 trip to Moscow for the Miss Universe pageant. But why is a question about Paul Manafort's outreach to Russia drawing so much attention? Remind us.
Well, Paul Manafort is facing charges in the federal court system for money laundering and conspiracy and other tax evasion type offenses, but he hasn't actually been indicted or charged by prosecutors with conspiring with these Russians. All the same, the federal prosecutors in this case have made allusions in court documents to contacts that Manafort and other people have had with a Russian that they say is assessed to have ties with Russia's intelligence operations. And so there's this kind of unfinished part of the equation that's been dangling out there. And if, in fact, these are the questions that the special counsel's office wanted to ask the president, this could suggest that it has more evidence that it might not have made public yet, closing that link and actually establishing a tie from Trump to Manafort to that Russian or another interlocutor on the Russian side to take some action. Now, that hasn't been established yet. We don't know if that's for real, but that is the suggestion that comes out of these questions in terms of the way they phrase that relationship.
Well, these came out last night, and also last night Paul Manafort filed for asking for a hearing and saying that not just these leaks, but leaks in general would jeopardize his getting a fair trial. Does he have a point?
Well, that is going to be the subject of a hearing this week in federal court down in Virginia. My other colleague, Carrie Johnson, who's been on the Justice beat for a long time, is going to go to that hearing. And she has described how Manafort is telling a judge that there's not going to be any way for him to get a fair process because of what he calls this concerted effort within the Justice Department itself to get these documents out into the public, either from the leadership level of with James Comey, the former FBI director, or wherever else these documents originate from that we continue to see in the New York Times and the Washington Post and elsewhere in the press. And we'll have to see how responsive a judge is to that request. But he certainly is going to make that case as part of his response and his pushback to the Justice Department because he's facing these very serious charges.
There are questions about fired National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, fired for misleading officials about his contacts with Russians. Questions about fired FBI Director James Comey, about Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who recused himself, about the president's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. Just got half a minute here. What jumped out at you?
You know, the thing that jumped out at me about this is how little new or how little unexpected there was about these questions. Our accounting and our understanding of this story from press reports, from court documents, from public statements in Congress appears, based on these questions, to be more or less complete. There were no bombshells. There were no fireworks that came out of this that said, wow, that's something brand new that we hadn't been expecting, which is helpful if you're trying to wrap your arms around the story the way so many Americans are.
But Phil, just take a few more seconds. Is it true, as the president said, there's also no collusion?
Well, there's questions about collusion. He said in his tweet there were no questions about it. There are certainly questions about that. You mentioned the one about Paul Manafort, and there are other contacts that his aides had with Russians or intermediaries that the special counsel's office apparently wants to ask about. So that definitely is very much a theme in this list of questions that the Times published.
NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing, thank you.
Thank you.
The International Atomic Energy Agency said today that it has no credible evidence that Iran had a nuclear weapons program after 2009. This after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's claims yesterday that Iran is lying about its nuclear program. Netanyahu made his allegations in a primetime address just days before President Trump has to decide whether to stick with the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, a deal Israel staunchly opposes. Netanyahu also made the address in English, something he was asked about on CNN today.
This is a very important subject, which relates to our quest for peace and security in the Middle East and the world. And I thought it was important that the broadest audience possible would hear the dramatic findings that we found about Iran's secret nuclear weapons program.
Joining me now is Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, first, does Netanyahu provide any evidence that Iran failed to abide by the 2015 nuclear agreement that President Trump is deciding on?
No, that's the goal he'd like to have people come to, but that's not actually true. He accused Iran of conducting a secret nuclear weapons program, which we largely know about. It's called Project Ahmad until 2003. The issue is Netanyahu has uncovered some documents. We can't speak to the authenticity of it, but it's documents and CDs that he says showed that Iran lied about its nuclear ambitions before the deal was signed in 2015. Again, that's something most of the world sort of believed to be true if they didn't know to be true. But the issue is whether or not that means that they were still conducting nuclear activity after 2009, and that's not been proved, and the International Atomic Energy Agency says the same. They said they have no evidence to that effect.
Well, what is the Trump administration saying about these claims from Netanyahu?
Well, there are some who think that the release of that information by Netanyahu was done in concert with the Trump administration. Secretary of State Pompeo said the documents, in his words, were proof beyond any doubt that the Iran regime was not telling the truth. So I guess the issue is you can believe both things to be true. The Iranian regime may not have been telling the truth about the fact that they said they never intended to have a nuclear bomb. There is evidence that they may have been working toward that new nuclear program. But a lot of people are saying, well, then that's all the more reason to maintain the deal with Iran than to get out of it. Because if they really do have continued nuclear weaponry aspirations, the deal actually contains that.
Well, Ali, you were in Iran when this deal was made. Can you remind us, what did Iran have to give up?
Well, Iran had to give up the right to enrich its uranium to the level that you would need to make nuclear bombs. And in order to do that, you have to have a lot of centrifuges. It had 20,000 centrifuges. It now has 6,000. So the fact is Iran can't get up to speed fast enough without the world figuring it out that they are breaking their rules, and they have to be subject to inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency. What Iran really needed was it had been cut off from the world financially. You can't use international credit cards there. You couldn't transfer money in and out of Iran. So it was an industrialized society that had lost its ability to trade with the world, and they had hyperinflation as a result and all of that. So in order to be re-welcomed into the global community, Iran had to give this up. And most Iranians whom I spoke to at the time were saying that's a good deal. They need to be a member of the global community, and if they have to give up a nuclear program to do it, most Iranians I spoke to were fine with that.
Should we be skeptical of the timing of Netanyahu's presentation here, just days ahead of President Trump's decision on the Iran deal, even though officials say Israelis stole these documents from an Iranian warehouse back in January?
Yeah. So remember, in March of 2015, Netanyahu gave a speech to the U.S. Congress to try and get them not to do the Iran deal. He wasn't successful there, so he wants to take no chances. The thinking out there is that Donald Trump is going to decertify the Iran deal before May 12th. Netanyahu is taking no chances. You'll see that he made most of his speech in English. And while he's a very sophisticated guy and Israeli intelligence is very sophisticated, it was a very simple presentation. Some say that there was an audience of one. It was for President Trump to say, see, Iran is a bad actor and we got to get out of the deal. The trick here is that a lot of people agree Iran is a bad actor. That's different from whether or not Iran is sticking up to its end of the Iran deal.
And we just have a few seconds left. Just tell us, how has Iran responded to these claims from Israel?
They've called it a stunt. They said that the documents are a rehash of old allegations that have already been dealt with. Still, Iran has been caught in a bit of a lie. They said that they weren't looking for a nuclear weapon, and the evidence is that they probably were. But Iran says there'll be no changes to the deal.
Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's May, the start of graduation season. Speakers everywhere will try to live up to the wise words of what was rumored to be Kurt Vonnegut, then revealed to be a column from the Chicago Tribune's Mary Schmeek, which Baz Luhrmann made into a hit in the 90s.
Ladies and gentlemen of the class of 99, wear sunscreen.
Baz Luhrmann's Everybody's Free to Wear Sunscreen. We'll post it at hereandnow.org. Mary Schmeek goes on in her column to suggest that graduates not only wear sunscreen, but sing, floss, don't be reckless with other people's hearts, do one thing every day that scares you. Well, author and Miami Herald columnist Carl Hiaasen has a different take. He's just published Assume the Worst, the graduation speech you'll never hear, with illustrations by New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast. Carl, welcome back.
Thanks for being brave enough to have me on.
Because what a frightening thing you've laid out. What you do is you lay out some of the things that graduates have been told over the years, like live every day as if it's your last.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. My advice is live every day as if your rent is due tomorrow. Live every day as if it's your last is terrific advice for a Labrador retriever because that's how they live. But if you're going into the real world as we know it in 2018, you have to arm your kids with some reality and armor them with some preparation for what's out there.
Yeah. You see, well, it continues in that vein. Try to find goodness in everyone you meet. You write, another waste of time.
Total waste of time. If you spend 5 minutes with somebody and their goodness and their decency isn't manifest in 5 minutes, move on. Say goodbye because they're not anyone you want to hang with. I mean, you have to move quick. You have to have quick judgments because you're being judged all the time. The world we're sending our kids into judges quickly and harshly, and you have to get attuned to that.
Look, you're allowed to have some cynicism, Carl Hiaasen, because you, after all, are the man who's really one of the biggest writers behind The Man from Florida genre, you know, the crazy, wacky things that people do in Florida. But you're not a complete cynic.
No. I base this because I have a son who's going off to college this year, and I thought, what words could I possibly say to him that would be helpful, not just reach for your dreams, reach for the sky. That's great. But the reality is that the limit is actually probably much lower than the sky for most people, even bright, talented, smart people. Get good at something, go do it, and then go out and do good things. You mentioned earlier one of those speeches where it says, you know, do something scary every day. Well, I still write for the Miami Herald, and the scariest thing I do every day is look at the headlines.
And, we want to get to that in a second. But this is it's a slim little book. It's got perfect illustrations from Roz Chast. Her drawings, they're all like shaky, like everybody's shaky and everybody looks nervous because of the way she does these squiggly line drawings.
She was asked about that and she says, well, I think I was probably born anxious. And her view and my view of reality in the world are very similar, it turns out. And that's not just doom and gloom. It's sort of more like, okay, brace yourself because here is the reality. But you can still go out and do wonderful, fantastic things. If I were talking to a real class, they'll never let me give this speech, but if I was and I would look out in that audience, you could predict with absolute certainty that there's going to be some incredible great work come out of the kids that you're looking at. There's no doubt about it. They're going to do terrific things and change people's lives for the better. And there's also, just as predictably, you can say that some of them are really just going to just take up oxygen.
Yeah.
And that's going to be it. They're going to max out as organisms and not contribute much. That's true, too.
Look, yeah, you're not saying live every day as if it's your last. But you're right. Always aspire to act in a way that cancels out someone else's cruel or stupid behavior.
Yeah, and there's a lot of it out there. And if you can do something to mitigate or make someone's life better, you know, who just got stomped on or kicked around a little bit, then do it. I mean, that's not a magical formula. It's just a matter of decency. You know, you want the numbers to work out so that the good people always outnumber those who are not always good or are not always interested. You know, you be attentive, be sharp, be alert, pay attention to what's happening in the world. We live in a time where you have to be on your toes. That's a fact. It really doesn't pay to be carefree. And there's something wrong with you, my argument would be. There's something wrong with someone who walks out into the real world in a perpetual state of being carefree right now. This is a dicey place.
Well, and this brings us to the story that's right in your backyard, the students of Parkland High School.
Yeah.
Who went
yeah,
through the
that was of course, I mean, I went to high school about 10 miles from where the Parkland High School is, so it hit home to me. I know people whose children were at that school, and, you know, my own son being in high school in Florida, public high school, it was all, you know, but to see them rise up like this and the strength they have in the face of some very vicious, you know, sort of online conspiracy theory attacks and those nut jobs coming after them, that's been inspiring. I mean, it goes to the point, Robin, of what I was saying is that all this is possible, but none of it is easy. Mm. They were thrown into the most hideous of situations imaginable, yet here they are strong and their voices are loud and they know how to work the internet, and they know how to go online and not only defend themselves but advance their beliefs. These are tools we never had when we were kids. Now, look at what's happening.
Author and Miami Herald columnist Carl Hiaasen. Carl, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And Carl Hiaasen's little book is Assume the Worst, the graduation speech you'll never hear, with illustrations by Roz Chast. Well, now a reminder of some good in the world in the Great Plains, where wildfires torched hundreds of thousands of acres of grassland last month. Insurance might cover fences, some lost cattle, but the grass cattle eat is all gone. And even if some farmers have insurance on hay, there's none around. So through a network built on Facebook and word of mouth, ranchers from across the country have been donating their own. Bernie Smith raises cattle in Gate, Oklahoma, on the Kansas border. And Bernie, I understand you and others have been loading bales onto 18-wheelers and crisscrossing the prairie for days now.
Yes, that's correct. We have two trucks of our own. And when the fire got over enough to where they started needing hay, we started putting together a hay relief.
Well, yeah, so look, these hay bales, I mean, these are huge and valuable things. What happens when you roll in with these free hay bales that you're giving to these burnt-out farmers?
Okay, kind of the way that happens normally is I know people of the area down there, and I contact them and find us a ranch to go to that is in need of hay. And when we pull in, of course, they're really glad to see us. And one particular ranch, they had 150 cows to feed. They had 4 bales of hay left when our truck pulled in the yard. There's nothing to eat. The fire has burned everything, the grass, the trees, the hay that they had. And so they were about to get in a real bind. And the people are really glad to see us when we get there.
Well, and you know that feeling, because do I understand you got burned your grasslands a year ago and the hay was a lifesaver for you?
That's correct. Yeah, a year ago in March, it burned all of our ranch, and we lost many cows. And before the fires were even out, the hay started coming in from near and far.
Where'd it come from?
Ohio, Michigan, Virginia, Kentucky, yeah. Montana, the Dakotas, and then, of course, locally, Missouri, Kansas, Texas, New Mexico.
Wow.
It just came from everywhere, and it came through just working people. The government had nothing to do with it. It was just one rancher to another. And we had groups of people that would take time off from work, and they'd borrow a trailer and load hay, and they'd come this way not knowing anyone on this end. They'd just show up and find somebody to take the hay.
Well, I'm reading accounts of some Montana ranchers each put in about $1,000 to make the trip and bring bales of hay to bring this to you in on the Kansas-Oklahoma border. Really quite something. And so how did that feel for you?
Well, it was good. I was quite surprised, quite frankly, because we didn't know what we were going to do because it burned everything. And I am also the local fire chief, and we were still fighting fire when the first loads of hay came in. We didn't even get a chance to really thank them, only over the phone, because we were still fighting fire.
Well, you're thanking them now over the radio.
Right.
What would you like to tell them?
Well, I'd like to tell them that they've... I personally feel it's the greatest thing that's happened in America in my lifetime. I'm 57 years old. The people are very thankful, but they're very proud, and sometimes they don't really want to take the free hay, but I've assured them it's quite fine to do that as long as the next time it's their turn to pay it forward. And so that's what we've done, and it's working quite well.
Oh, it sounds it. It's a wonderful thing. We understand there's bales of hay left by the sides of the road to contribute. And, you know, again, to underscore how terrible when cattle are injured by these fires, you have to slaughter them, you know, but how painful to have them survive the fire. And then for as far as the eye can see, there's nothing to feed them. They will starve to death. It's not like you can go to Petco.
No,
for cattle.
That's correct. And out here, you're not talking about feeding 10 head of cattle. You're talking about 300 or 500 or... it takes a lot of hay. A normal adult cow would eat, she'll eat as much as you let her eat, but she'll comfortably eat 30 to 40 pounds of hay a day.
Well, listen, Bernie Smith, rancher, volunteer firefighter in Gate, Oklahoma, who has been one of those helping bring bales of hay to other farmers who've been wiped out as he was last year by these grass fires. I tell you, Bernie, I will never look at bale of hay on a you know, big rig rolling down an interstate the same way again.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay, and thank you, guys, and I appreciate everyone wanting to know about it.
North Carolina has more hogs than nearly any other state, and for years, people have been trying to turn hog waste into electricity. Well, this year, Duke University researchers made a major leap forward in their effort to turn every hog farm in the state into a renewable source. WUNC's James Morrison reports.
In 2010, Duke University piloted a system for turning hog excrement into electricity. This system is still running at Lloyd Ray Farm in Yadkinville, hundreds of miles west of where most of the state's hogs live. Marvin Cavanaugh is the owner of the engineering firm Cavanaugh Solutions, which designed the farm's anaerobic digestion system.
It's like feeding a baby. You got to feed that baby when that thing's hungry, and it stays hungry.
On any hog farm, water is used to flush waste out of the barns and into a lagoon. Bacteria eats away and creates methane. Instead of letting that methane bubble into the atmosphere and increase greenhouse gases, Cavanaugh captures it by covering the lagoon with a giant pool cover.
A big storage balloon is what it amounts to.
That methane is then cleaned and turned into natural gas that's turned into electricity. The goal of this system is for Duke University and Google to earn carbon offset credits by eliminating the pig farm's methane, which is 25 times more potent than CO2. If you create a little natural gas in the process, that's just an added benefit. But as more companies and countries move away from fossil fuels, this renewable natural gas is starting to become a lot more attractive.
We had two teams from China came, was asking what they were going to do with the gas. So we're going to bottle it and burn it in our cars. I said, it's not cost effective. He said, maybe not for you. What you pay for gas, but what we pay for gas, it's very effective.
Over the past 7 years, the project at Lloyd Ray Farms has taught Cavanaugh and Duke University how to scale the production process and squeeze more gas out of each hog farm. Meanwhile,
the Optima KV project will probably generate enough electricity that 1,000 homes would use in a year.
That's Randy Wheelis of Duke Energy, which is purchasing Cavanaugh's swine biogas to meet a state-required mandate. The Optima KV project came online in late March and directs biogas from 5 area hog farms into a natural gas pipeline that feeds a nearby Duke Energy power plant.
We think we can burn that at existing power plants and get a lot more energy out of it than the conventional way, which was to burn it on site at the farms.
A 2013 Duke University study found this pipeline approach could lower the cost of swine biogas to as little as 5 cents a kilowatt hour. That's roughly the same price as solar power. And there's a reason Duke University is interested in lowering the price of renewable natural gas. It has a goal of dropping its emissions to zero by 2024. And while solar and wind energy can get the university most of the way there, it's still not enough. Massive boilers at Duke University need a combustible fuel source to turn water into steam that will heat campus buildings. The plan is to convert the boilers from burning natural gas to burning swine biogas.
And that means we would be able to run on a renewable energy source, and we would also get credit for destroying that methane that's coming off of those lagoons.
Tanya Voigt is the director of biogas strategy at Duke University. She envisions a time in the near future where all North Carolina hog farms will be connected to a renewable natural gas pipeline. And she says it shouldn't stop with hog waste, since biogas can be made from food scraps, chicken poop, and even human waste.
Once we develop the infrastructure for a biogas market in North Carolina, you're going to see those other sectors find ways to make biogas as well. It's sort of field of dreams. If you build it, they will come.
Except this field of dreams is made of poop. For Here and Now, I'm James Morrison in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
The opioid crisis is reaching around the world. In Nigeria, thousands of young people are addicted to codeine cough syrup, a common medicine that has become a street drug. The BBC explored the crisis in a 5-month investigation. There's a link to the reporting at hereandnow.org. Adejua Soyinka, editor of the BBC Pidgin Service, joins us from Lagos to talk about it. Adejua, welcome. Tell us, how bad is the cough syrup addiction problem in Nigeria, the scale of it?
I think it's really big. And, you know, it's such a big issue because just two states in Nigeria, Kano and Jigawa states, account for about 3 million bottles of cough syrup with codeine consumed on a daily basis.
We have some sound I want to play. This is a man named Sunny Usaini who works in a rehab center.
This thing is a serious issue. It is biting everybody. It is going from one home to another. If you think you are safe, you are not safe.
What does this addiction look like? What are the effects?
It's wide-ranging. So you find some of them acting rather funny. They walk slowly, they talk slowly, they act slowly. And it took many years for people to understand that this was actually a sign of addiction to codeine. At some point, it progresses into, you know, things like schizophrenia. It progresses into, according to doctors, liver damage, kidney damage, and damages of all sorts of organs. And if you look at the video, you know, visuals from the rehabilitation center in Kano that we visited, you could see a lot of people who are practically deranged, more or less. The effect on the human body is really damaging.
I saw images of people chained to the floor because the withdrawal symptoms are so severe.
Yes, and because, I mean, according to the handlers of the center, they were said to be really very violent. And, you know, there was an instance where one of them was said to have yanked up the door, yanked up the window. They tend to be, according to the experts, that they tend to be suicidal and that they could not only harm themselves but also harm other people, you know, in the center. And that's why, according to them, they've resorted to that rather crude method of chaining them to the ground.
BBC reporters went undercover to try to find out how people are getting this cough syrup, which is supposed to be available only with a prescription. What did they find?
Our undercover reporting, you know, revealed the leakage in the system. And when I say the system, I mean the supply chain system in the pharmaceutical industry in Nigeria. And that's exactly what we set out to do, really, because we found that, yes, it's not enough to just tell the story that young people are abusing codeine. It's not enough to tell the story that they now hold codeine parties, I mean, parties where codeine is served on the table like drinks. But we want to find out, why is it possible for them to get codeine in large quantity? We met, you know, some unscrupulous sales executives of pharmaceutical companies, you know, unscrupulous pharmacists who were willing to do business, you know, and divert this product into the black market, and that's what they do. You know, we were able to buy from them, and we were able to film that successfully as well.
Has there been any reaction from the manufacturers of the cough syrup to your findings that there were unscrupulous employees who were willing to sell this to young kids?
Yes, there's been a lot of reaction. And in one specific instance, the big pharmaceutical company in Lagos that was affected, Emzor Pharmaceuticals, as at this morning, has issued a statement saying that it has summarily dismissed the business executive that diverted products to me while I was undercover, and also suspended further production of codeine product, further production and distribution of codeine cough syrup. Outside of that, of course, at the public or private screening of the documentary last night, we had representatives of the Pharmaceutical Society of Nigeria in attendance, and they also spoke about measures that they're willing to take now to stop the spread of codeine cough syrup in Nigeria. We've also heard reactions from the wife of the Nigerian president. She's issued a statement today, you know, lamenting the rise of codeine cough syrup abuse and other drug abuse in the society.
Adejua Soyinka, editor of the BBC's Pidgin Service, speaking with us from Lagos in Nigeria. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, now to Cleveland, where a new proposal could one day see travelers climb into pods and zip through vacuum tubes between Cleveland and Chicago at hundreds of miles an hour. Regional transportation planners will study whether the so-called Hyperloop is feasible, even though the technology hasn't even been developed. It's not the first time Cleveland has explored an ambitious transportation project. As IdeaStream's Nick Castell reports, Hyperloop is up against a long history of transit dreams that never came true.
In the early 1950s, Cleveland was at the height of its population with nearly a million residents, and the city was starting to change. Cleveland State University professor Mark Souther says cars were making inroads into mass transit, made up of buses, trains, trolleys, and a few remaining streetcars.
But there was a concern that you needed to serve the whole city and you needed to keep downtown strong and let people access it more easily and not just have everyone coming down into the city in their cars and clogging the roads.
In 1953, Cuyahoga County voters broke 2-1 in favor of building a downtown subway. County engineer Albert S. Porter resisted the campaign. He advocated for freeways, not trains, to relieve Cleveland's congestion.
He believed that downtown was inevitably going to lose out to the suburbs, and that you really shouldn't try to stop that, that the natural progression of cities was to decentralize.
County commissioners rejected the subway twice, in 1957 and 1959. Around a decade later, a very different downtown project captivated Cleveland's leaders, a new airport built on the waters of Lake Erie.
Lake Erie International Jetport Project holds the promise of Cleveland Northeastern Ohio region and the state of Ohio once again becoming a thriving center of transportation.
In December 1971, the head of May Company, Francis A. Coy, joined elected officials and other businessmen to pitch the idea.
The project provides a basis for a totally planned transportation system around which a city and an entire region can be rebuilt.
A lot of places were scrambling, kind of come up with plans that would allow them to expand their airport or build a new, bigger airport that could accommodate all of the new travel.
University of Dayton professor Janet Bednarik says air travel was growing nationwide. The Greater Cleveland Growth Association envisioned state-of-the-art jets zooming in and out of an airport on a man-made island in Lake Erie. The airport would be 5 miles from Cleveland's shore.
There was going to be a causeway that would link to it, that would carry all kinds of traffic back and forth. It was huge. It was just massive.
A later plan proposed building an island several times the size of Cleveland's current airport, 4 miles from the breakwater. A 13-mile dike would protect the 6,300-acre island from the surrounding lake. But after more than $4 million spent on feasibility studies throughout the 1970s, the jetport never left the tarmac. Today, Cleveland Hopkins International Airport is about 9 miles from downtown. Meanwhile, Mayor Ralph Perk was pushing a new transit idea, an elevated tram called the People Mover, circling downtown. Cleveland had won $41 million from the federal government to build it. In 1976, Perk told reporters that a federal official thought Cleveland had the finest proposal.
He made many trips to Cleveland. He's tremendously impressed with the progress being made in Cleveland.
The city offered to chip in $500,000 for an engineering study. One of Perk's fellow Republicans, then Cuyahoga County Commissioner George Voinovich, opposed that.
Not one dime should be spent on this project. With $500,000, we could repair the parks. We could do something about the roads, and we could clean up the dirty city that we have.
The next mayor, Dennis Kucinich, put an end to the People Mover.
Which surprised the feds incredibly.
Norman Krumholz was the city's planning director at the time.
They had never been in a situation where a mayor has sent money back to Washington.
So not all dreams come true. But if Hyperloop does someday send people rocketing to and from Chicago, it will have avoided the fate of many Northeast Ohio ideas that fell short of reality. For Here and Now, I'm Nick Castell in Cleveland.
And historic audio in this story came from the Northeast Ohio Broadcast Archives at John Carroll University.
A new live stream on YouTube gives listeners the chance to eavesdrop on whales and other sea creatures off the coast of Northern California, 3,000 feet below the surface. You're listening to the sounds of a humpback whale and a sperm whale. They were captured by an underwater microphone placed on the sea floor a few years ago by the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. We have a link to the live stream at hereandnow.org. Joining us is John Ryan, the lead scientist on the project. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Mina. Good to be here.
Good to have you. So how did the idea for the project even come about?
A friend of mine asked me one day, why isn't MBARI, that's Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, doing more with listening in the ocean? And I thought that was a really good question because we already had a cabled observatory, this connection to the deep sea with a cable, which gives us power and communications. And so I proposed a project that would put a hydrophone, an underwater microphone, on that cabled observatory.
How did you get the mic down there?
We used a remotely operated vehicle, and already in place was the deep sea cabled observatory. So it has on it a number of science ports where you can bring your experiment down to the deep ocean and plug in. And the amazing thing about that is here you are 3,000 feet below the surface in salt water, and you can just plug it in and it works.
Has the microphone ever gone offline? And what do you do if it does?
The good news about being connected in real time is that you know if it's working or not. And yes, on occasion, we've had some internal network issues that have briefly interrupted the continuous stream, but we also have the ability to know when those problems arise and fix them.
Well, let's take a listen to another whale sound captured by the underwater microphone. This is a blue whale. Tell us what we were hearing there, John, in that clip.
It is true. That is a recording of a blue whale. However, it's played back at a speed 5 times normal. And the reason we do that is that most speakers, for example, your computer speakers or your phone speaker, can't represent the very low frequency sounds of a blue whale B-call. So what's a lot more fun is if you play it back at normal speed through a substantial subwoofer and let the walls shake. But that's part of the fun of it, is you never know on any given day what you're going to hear.
So what do you see as the potential for the scientific value of this? How do you see this continuous recording being used?
Well, two of the species, the blue whales and the fin whales, they're still endangered. Their populations still have not recovered from the whaling days. And so in order to effectively protect this recovering species, we need to understand their ecology and how their ecology varies with changes in the environment. And the great advantage of listening is that we can listen all the time. We can study these migratory giants with visual methods as well. Go out on a boat, get out the binoculars, identify the animals that we see at the surface. However, they're not spending all that much time at the surface. So with this research, we can build the solid scientific foundation for supporting the recovery of these endangered species. And, you know, just to follow up on that education and outreach, you know, this live stream kind of started with a temporary mobile exhibit so that we can represent the wide range of sounds that we record in the soundscape, from very high frequency sounds to very low frequency. But they're at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Exploration Center in Santa Cruz. We brought this mobile exhibit to the public, and we found that people were very quickly fascinated. And so we're in the process of developing a permanent exhibit there so that people can, for free, walk in and experience the ocean soundscape.
We had our producer listen to the live stream for about a half hour straight earlier today, and mostly she didn't hear anything except white noise. Are the whales, for example, more active at certain times of the day?
Absolutely. We released this live stream, or I should say the engineering to make this live stream work consistently. It just matured, and yet right now it's not the most vocal time for marine mammals. If we were listening in the fall, you would hear a much greater variety. And that's, of course, why we've given people options. You know, if you tune into the soundscape and it's quiet, you can go to the listening room and hear pre-recorded clips of different species. And if you're a science geek, you can browse the entire archive with what we call soundscape visual browsing. You can watch the soundscape stream by with visual representations or spectrograms. And that's actually an important research tool for us. Our collaborators can quickly scan the sound content of a very long period of time and let us know what time periods they're interested in for study. And then we can give them the raw data so that they can do their research.
John Ryan is with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. John, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mina.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Mina Kim.
I'm Robin Young, and I'm looking at the website. It's fantastic, Mina. People have to go there. It's Here and Now.